and preserving farmland. The event features live music, food and drinks, a raffle, and more. Again, that's the Portland Solstice Celebration on Thursday, June 28th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Listening to KBOO Portland, and tonight on Queer Boo, we're going to play two episodes of This Way Out. One is going to be about Stracey Stonewall, From Riot to Celebration, High Courts Consider Marriage Equality in the Philippines and Peru. And then the second episode would be iconic queer historian Lillian Fetterman, Milks, The Unknown Harvey is the name of the show. Enjoy.
I never have read about it.
No, I don't know nothing about it.
The disorders began with a routine police raid on a homosexual bar, the Stonewall, on Christopher Street.
Love, hot, summer, from now on.
I think they thought that people would just go home or run, especially since they were gay people. They're not used to gay people standing up at all, especially in front of police.
Gay history rap!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Marriage equality proposals reach three high courts and a legislature. South Africa's Equality Court rejects a religious right to hate. And tracing Stonewall from Riot to Celebration. All that and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Monique Lukens.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 23rd, 2018. Marriage equality is on the march in several countries around the world. The Philippine Supreme Court began hearing oral arguments on a petition to open the civil institution to same-gender couples on June 19th. Jesus Nicardo Falcis III, who became a lawyer just 3 years ago, filed a petition. Two of the justices warned him about what one called this very dangerous case that will require a very intimate reading of the provisions of the Constitution. Falcis acknowledged that he was fighting a very powerful heteronormative culture by initiating the case. Controversial President Rodrigo Duterte has previously voiced his support for changing the law in the predominantly Roman Catholic Southeast Asian nation. But presidential spokesman Harry Roque told a press briefing late this week that the Supreme Court and the country are not yet ready for same-sex marriage, adding that it may still be too revolutionary. The government is expected to formally argue its opposition at the Supreme Court on June 26th. There is no time limit for the High Court to issue its decision, and some say it could literally take years.
Peru's Constitutional Court heard a case on June 20th filed by Oscar Ugarteche demanding the legal recognition of his marriage in 2010 to Mexican citizen Fidel Aroche. A lower court in the South American nation had rejected the case on a legal technicality. According to an English-translated report in El Comercio, the court has 30 days to issue a ruling.
And on June 21st, Cayman Islands lawyer Chantel Day and her partner Vicky Bowden-Bush, a nurse from Britain, filed a writ with the Grand Court challenging the government's decision to refuse their application to marry. Their lawyers argue that the laws of the Western Caribbean British Overseas Territory, defining marriage as between one man and one woman, violate a number of rights guaranteed under the Cayman's Constitution.
Marriage equality may come to gay and lesbian couples in the Czech Republic through legislation rather than the courts. Equality advocates are celebrating the announcement by the Czech government on June 22nd that it was supporting a bill to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. A cross-party collection of 46 lawmakers drafted the bill. An opposing bill sponsored by 37 lawmakers calls for a heterosexuals only definition of marriage to be enshrined in the country's constitution. The Eastern European nation has offered registered partnerships to same-gender couples since 2006. With the government's backing, it now seems poised to become the first former Soviet bloc country to grant all the rights of civil marriage to those couples. However, major parties have been struggling to create a fully functional government since last October's divisive elections, so it's uncertain exactly when Parliament might begin to actually debate the opposing marriage proposals.
In other news, South Africa's Equality Court has ruled that hate speech is not a protected religious right. It found Cape Town preacher Oscar Buchard of Calvary Hope Ministries in contempt of court for continuing to spew hateful anti-queer rhetoric in public pronouncements, on social media, and in widely distributed email messages. He had promised the South African Human Rights Commission in 2013 to stop distributing what it called derogatory and offensive statements following formal complaints lodged against him. Buchard has written that homosexuals are an abomination to God and should be locked up in cages. He's falsely claimed that 99% of pedophiles are homosexual. And after he read about the execution by the so-called Islamic State in Syria of 9 men and a boy for homosexuality, Buchard appealed to ISIS to come rid South Africa of the homosexual curse. South African culture is still catching up with the laws of the land, which ban sexual orientation-based bias in the Constitution and prohibit public comments that are hurtful, harmful, or promote hatred against gay people. Entrenched societal prejudices still prevail, however, and can be expressed violently, even in major cities, but especially in outlying townships. The Equality Court ordered Buchard to spend 30 days in jail, but suspended the sentence for 5 years. If he makes hateful comments about LGBTQ people in public again during that time, he could go straight to jail.
The World Health Organization has finally removed transgender people from its list of mental disorders. It announced on June 18th that what's generally called gender dysphoria is now characterized by a marked and persistent incongruence between an individual's experienced gender and the assigned sex. While evidence is now clear that it is not a mental disorder, the press release said, "There remain significant health care needs that can best be met if what it called gender incongruence is reclassified as a sexual health condition." The statement says that the change was made, in part, to combat the stigma that transgender people face and to reduce barriers to care. Some trans activists, however, remain unhappy about what they consider to still be negative connotations about them in the new classification. Progress, even to this point, has been a long time coming. France was the first country to declassify gender dysphoria as a mental disorder 8 years ago. A few other countries have since followed. The European Parliament called on the WHO to declassify gender dysphoria as a mental disorder in 2011, and the American Psychiatric Association declassified it in 2012.
One day after the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights denounced the Trump administration's immigration policy of separating children from their parents who've illegally crossed the southern border as unconscionable, America's UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, announced that the U.S. was withdrawing from the world body's Human Rights Council. It's the first country ever to do so. She charged that the council was anti-Israel, a protector of human rights abusers, and a cesspool of political bias. LGBTQ groups joined the chorus of human rights organizations across the country to condemn the move. Ty Cobb of the Human Rights Campaign wrote that, "In recent years, the UN Human Rights Council advanced a number of initiatives focused on LGBTQ human rights, including a 2016 decision establishing an independent expert on sexual orientation and gender identity. With this decision, the Trump-Pence administration is leaving a vacuum at the Human Rights Council that may well be filled by countries that have little or no commitment to universal human rights." Outright Action International released a statement saying in part that, "Withdrawing from the council sends a message to other countries that it is acceptable to walk away from the system when it doesn't suit you to be there." Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez didn't pull any punches, criticizing the Trump administration for sending a signal to the world that we're too weak to lead and too cowardly to fight for our foundational values. Trump's withdrawal is especially disturbing given his persistent praise for despots and dictators with abysmal human rights records, not to mention his administration's cruel mistreatment of immigrant families seeking asylum.
But finally...
It's you.
It's me.
And you're Jewish.
Yeah. And I'm black, too. And gay.
That's the now award-winning kiss, generally cheered around the world, from the hit mainstream gay romantic coming-of-age comedy, Love, Simon. Exceptions include India, which banned the film on the day of its planned release earlier this month because of its depiction of gay relationships. But at the MTV Awards on June 16th in Santa Monica, California, the object of Simon's affection, Bram, played by out bisexual Australian actor Keon Lonsdale, was a clear audience favorite, especially because, as one fashion critic put it, the 26-year-old actor rocked a skirt and looked absolutely fabulous doing it.
And best kiss goes to...
Love, Simon. Nick Robinson and Kevin Lopez.
Wow. Wow. First of all, I know Nick really wishes he could be here because I know that he would be so grateful for this moment. I just want to say to every kid, you can live your dreams and wear dresses. You can live your dreams. You can live your dreams and kiss the one that you love, no matter what gender they are. You can live your dreams and you can believe in magic. You can live your dreams and you can be yourself. Thank you so much.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending June 23rd, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the all-new thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Monique Lukens.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Living up, living up, living up proud.
Was blamed by some on the recent death of Judy Garland, or maybe it was the sweltering New York City summer heat, Or maybe it was the contagion of a civil rights movement instilling pride in the possibility of political power into long-oppressed minorities. But the world would never be the same after June 27, 1969. Aside from the chance to let their hair down, many people attending events celebrating the Stonewall riots may not even be able to tell you why that uprising is a historic turning point worth celebrating. So This Way Out combed the rich audio archives at our disposal to assemble this LGBTQ Pride Primer.
My sweet Sherry, how long will you run? No hiding place over there, over there.
Before the last weekend of June in 1969, it was illegal in many U.S. cities to serve alcohol to homosexuals or for two men to dance together. Gay bars were often run by organized crime, drink prices were inflated, and police raids and subsequent public ruination were routine. All that changed when the queer patrons of the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street in New York City's Greenwich Village finally had enough.
Strutting around like a heavy duty
pup. I wanna be free.
Now I know we got to get tough, and we can sing it loud now. We can sing it loud now. We can sing it loud now.
Yeah, I'm proud.
Parades and festivals celebrating gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender pride are now held in cities all over the world practically all year round, but the tradition was born in June. Unfortunately, it's not surprising to discover that many people, even those who come out to enjoy the celebrations, don't know what event they're commemorating.
Do you know what the Stonewall riots were about?
I never have read about it. What exactly happened there and the purpose of it?
I've never heard anything about it. No, I don't know nothing about it.
So just what is this party all about? The significance of June 27, 1969 must be seen against the backdrop of life before that.
This is the new symposium, a program from and for the homosexual community. I'm Baird Searles, and also on hand,
Kermit Lamb.
This discussion was recorded at Pacifica Radio New York just 6 months before the historic event.
I have felt, and I think I've changed even my thinking on this in the last 3 or 4 years, is that homosexuals aren't proud enough to be homosexuals and get out and you know, be militant a little bit and say I am, and a little like I'm glad to see now in the racial thing that Negroes now aren't just trying to get along like everybody else. They've seen beauty in their own blackness.
Yeah.
Black is beautiful.
It bears on what you're saying about being proud of homosexual, which I think even at now is a little much to ask of most people, but just being open about it. Since doing this program, and kind of because of doing this program and trying to find people to do this program back at the beginning, it has come so sharply to my attention the total lack of courage that the homosexual community has. And I know the reasons, damn it, and I've been through it myself. I think that is one thing you can really pin on all of you out there is cowardice. I know I'm going to get letters saying, okay, it's easy for you, you're not going to get fired from the station. But it hasn't been that easy. The feeling that I've totally lost contact with my father because of this program. Mm. And I know that people's lives can be ruined if they open up and reveal themselves. On an idealistic plane, we all know that if every homosexual said what he was tomorrow, that the whole situation would be changed for the better. Now, this is obviously a pipe dream. But for every homosexual that does open up and reveal himself, there are that many more people that realize that homosexuals are real, breathing human beings. They are not sex maniacs or freaks. That many more young people that are given the fact that a homosexual life needn't be a disaster.
I know a number of people who are under 25, say, under 20, They all seem to be much more relaxed. I hope it's a sign.
I don't know. So do I.
There's a certain feeling among many younger people of not caring who knows. They have straight friends who know, and I hope this is sort of indicative of something.
Say it loud! Say it loud! Say it loud! Say it loud! Say it loud!
June 27th, 1969, as recalled in Brett Artery's 1970 documentary.
The disorders began with a routine police raid on a homosexual bar, the Stonewall, on Christopher Street. Almost every homosexual who was in New York at the time of the Stonewall Rebellion has his own private memory of what took place. One of the longtime leaders of the gay rights movement, Craig Rodwell, remembers it this way.
The first night was Friday. I was on the way home from a friend's house. The raid was just starting at that time, and we noticed the crowd, so we went over there. And a crowd was gathering out in front. There was a paddy wagon pulled up and a few people being taken out. It started with a few coins and pebbles being thrown at the police, and then the police retreated into the Stonewall. And then after the police barricaded themselves inside, it was like half an hour later, the riot police started moving up Christopher, breaking up the crowd, which had really become a very angry crowd with hundreds of bottles and rocks. There wasn't one window left in the whole place after about 10 minutes. And they broke the crowd up into small groups, and this went on for like 2 or 3 hours, back and forth in the whole area. I think they thought the people would just go home or run, especially since they were gay people. They're not used to gay people standing up at all, especially in front of police. But they would chase people away, and they would go around the block and come in another way. And this sort of tug of war went on all evening. And then on Saturday night, it was much the same thing. Starting about 9, crowds started to gather in the area. And then around 11 or 12, they started taking over the street, stopping cars from coming through, unless there were gay people in them. A few fires were set. But generally, there's an angry mood, a lot of chanting, a lot of hand-holding, a lot of assertion of being gay. It was a way of saying we're tired of hiding, tired of leading two lives, tired of denying our basic identity, denying ourselves. Newfound pride, really, a collective pride in their identity.
Another important outgrowth of the riots was the formation of numerous action-oriented homosexual groups in New York and around the country. They're composed for the most part of younger and more militant homosexuals.
It still is a relatively small minority of gay people who do reflect this new spirit, whatever you want to call it. I think it's going to infect the masses of gay people in the coming years.
Here to stay, and nobody is going to ignore us any longer.
Hey Joe, get up and go. Wouldn't like to tell you twice. Hey Mac, get off my back. Didn't ask your advice. There's too much heat out in the street, telling us to move along. Gonna be a long, hot summer.
the birth of the Gay Pride March, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. On November 2, 1969, in Philadelphia, the Eastern Regional Conference of Homophile Organizations made a resolution that sparked the creation of Gay Pride celebrations. In part, it read, "We propose that a demonstration be held annually on the last Saturday in June in New York City to commemorate the 1969 spontaneous demonstrations on Christopher Street, and this demonstration be called Christopher Street Liberation Day. No dress or age regulations shall be made for this demonstration. We also propose that we contact homophile organizations throughout the country and suggest that they hold parallel demonstrations on that day. We propose a nationwide show of support." Thus was born the Gay Pride Parade as we know it. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
This is Gabrielle Antolovich reporting from West Hollywood for This Way Out. You know what the Stonewall riots were about?
I know a little bit about them.
What do you know?
Oh, some cops came into a bar and some Long Beach cops and
New York.
Oh, New York, okay. Well, anyway, whatever city. But anyway, they came into the bar and they were trying to break up the gays or whatever. And then the gays kicked their butt. That's what I heard.
I just heard like a whole bunch of drag queens just sort of like, you know, barricaded the whole half of the city and just, you know, took over for about a few days.
You know that it wasn't just drag queens, it was leather boys and lesbians and people of color, too.
Yeah.
You know anything about the Stonewall riots?
I don't know a thing about them.
Well, what's the gay parade about?
I guess to celebrate the gay life.
Where you can touch in public and it doesn't, I guess, offend anybody, or you can just be yourself. You know that it's a yearly event to commemorate the Stonewall riots that happened in New York.
No! Did you know that?
No, I knew it was Stonewall, but I didn't know why they called it that.
Maybe I don't know enough about my culture.
Science.
Story of good.
Story of bad.
This story made us fightin' mad.
His story.
Her story.
Our story. Gay story. History. Gay history. Rap.
Well, back in 1969, a bad lumpy company named Seymour Pine and the boys in blue decided it was time to keep the figures and dice in line, so off they marched to a village bar. This time they pushed too far. Their mission was to punish sin. They met a surprise at the Stonewall Inn.
Gay history, rap! Stonewall Inn was a sleazy place. To get in, they had to know your face. Reason was mighty clear. You couldn't run a bar for queers. Prices inside were double. We paid them cause we didn't want trouble. Something was brewing inside. They got the dykes. Feeling pride, stage was set, people in place, cops and queers face to face.
History rap!
First three arrested were in drag, but these were not cringing fags. And a crowd gathered, seeing the scene, shouted support to those three queens. Through the door came one more queer, stocky little woman who knew no fear. Screaming, kicking, punching pigs, crowd gave a yell cause she wasn't too big. Running and hiding was a thing of the past, when this tough dice started kicking ass.
History rap!
Those cops and all around.
Feeling rage, cops hid in the very bar they were supposed to rent.
The crowd smashed down the door, fire spread across the floor.
Three days later, peace was restored. Hinges sprung on closet doors. History rap!
Maybe I don't know enough about my culture.
Sex and discos instead of rights.
Of course, Age of Consent's Gay History rap reads off before AIDS, marriage equality, gender nonconformity, and social media. But don't worry, There's a new swing to the right these days to keep us busy. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Monique Lukens, with thanks to Brian DeShazer, Sugar Beach, Mary Watkins, the Berkeley Women's Music Collective, and the Tom Robinson Band performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WMPG Portland, Maine, KOPN Columbia, Missouri, 5GTR Mount Gambier, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Played football and baseball and basketball. He did wrestling. He ran track. He played soccer. In college, he even wrote for 3 years for the college newspaper as their sports columnist. Then he went into the Navy, and he was a deep sea diver in the Navy. And he finally got a job on Wall Street as a securities analyst. It's not the Harvey Milk that we know.
No.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Queer historian Lillian Faderman milks the unknown Harvey. Poland's top court rejects a printer's refusal to make LGBT banners, and Tony winners rally for the resistance. Those stories and more this week, because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 16, 2018. Poland's Supreme Court ruled this week that a print shop employee violated the principle of equality before the law when he refused to make banners for the LGBT business forum because he didn't want to promote gay rights. The nation's top court upheld a lower court decision that the printer did not have the right to withhold services based on sexual orientation or other personal characteristics. Poland's Justice Minister and Attorney General Zbigniew Ziobro of the ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party brought the appeal. He angrily told reporters that the justices had served the ideology of homosexual activists. Many people, especially in the U.S., were quick to draw comparisons to last week's ruling by America's Supreme Court that upheld a Colorado baker's right, on narrow religious grounds, to refuse to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. Yaroslav Yaruga, a lawyer with the Helsinki Foundation for Human Rights, sees some similarities. But he noted that religious belief was not a specific factor in the Polish High Court decision. He said that while ruling that sexual orientation can't be the basis for refusal of service, the justices also said that there can be exceptions based on the nature of the service being rendered. Sometimes freedom of conscience and religion will be a legitimate reason for the refusal to perform the service, Yaruga explained, and at other times may constitute a manifestation of unauthorized discrimination.
Yet another U.S. federal court continues to deny President Trump's attempted ban on military service by qualified transgender enlistees from taking effect. Judge Marsha Peckman of the U.S. District Court for the Western District of the State of Washington issued a preliminary injunction against the ban in December and on June 15th denied the Trump administration's request to lift it. She said that the administration had not shown that it would suffer irreparable harm if the ban remained blocked, but that current and aspiring transgender service members would be hurt if it went into effect. "The status quo shall remain, steady as she goes," she wrote. and the preliminary injunction shall remain in full force and effect nationwide. Three other federal judges around the country have also blocked the ban from becoming a reality.
June's LGBTQ Pride Month is in full swing around the world. St. Croix and the U.S. Virgin Islands celebrated Pride for the first time on June 9th, despite anonymous social media threats that participants would be gunned down en masse. Local police and agents in the FBI field office in San Juan, Puerto Rico, are reportedly investigating the threats. Anti-queer protesters who were far outnumbered by Pride marchers were kept at bay by a strong police presence. Police Chief Winsbutt McFarland told local media that, at the end of the day, these individuals pay taxes, work in our community, and are members of our community. And because of that, my obligation is to the safety of this community, and that's what we did today. The Advocate spotted a few dignitaries in the crowd, including the territory's delegate to Congress, Stacey Plaskett, and gubernatorial candidate Albert Bryan. Bryan said that people in the Caribbean, many of whom are of African descent, should be able to relate to the fight for LGBT rights. He told the Virgin Islands Consortium that 67 years ago, we were the ones who were hosed when we were marching. So we have to realize that in this world, people have a right to be who they are.
Organizers said that 500,000 people attended Rome's annual Pride celebration on June 9th. With the theme of Rainbow Brigade Liberation Continues, marchers demanded that civil marriage replace the currently available but inferior civil unions and protested the denial of adoption rights to those couples.
Thousands also celebrated Pride on June 9th in two countries that are considered to be less than friendly to LGBTQ rights. According to the Associated Press, a party-like atmosphere prevailed in Warsaw as people waved rainbow flags and danced.
A festive mood also characterized the Pride parade in the Romanian capital of Bucharest. Activists there were especially celebrating the recent European Court of Justice ruling on behalf of a Romanian gay man and his American-born husband that requires all member states to grant residency to same-gender spouses, even if the country itself, like Romania, doesn't offer civil marriage to its own lesbian and gay couples.
China's largest city, Shanghai, celebrated its 10th year of Pride on June 9th. According to a report in Time magazine, more than 40 individual events began with a 3-mile fun run and included a pink brunch, a film festival, and a trivia night. China's communist government has not been consistent in its treatment of LGBTQ people or issues, allowing some queer cultural events to go on while censoring or shutting down others, most recently some popular queer-focused web sites. Brian Song, who helped organize Shanghai Pride's The Journey of Light Choir concert that featured English and Chinese songs performed by 7 LGBT-friendly choirs from across the country, told Time that, "We were a little bit worried that maybe our concert would get canceled because of the current environment regarding LGBT in the media."
A phobic Christian minister in Anchorage, Alaska, failed miserably in his effort to preach at what has become an increasingly popular new wrinkle on Pride celebrations. Pastor Dave Grisham of Last Frontier Evangelism posted video of himself bursting into the Luzac Public Library during a private drag queen story hour. It was an official event during Anchorage's Pride Fest celebration. His unscheduled appearance didn't go over well with the children or their parents.
Morris pretends he can't hear their words over the swish, 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 crinkle, 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 and click, click, click he makes when he walks.
Hey kids, my name is Pastor David, and I wanted to tell you today that there is no such thing as there's no such thing as transgenders. Transgenders do not exist. They do not exist. God made men women, men men, and women women.
You do not have a ticket, sir. You do not have a ticket. You are being disruptive. You do not have the right.
Grisham is well known in the Anchorage area for disrupting queer positive events. He's even tried his homophobic and transphobic preaching at LGBT Christmas parties where children were present.
Queer fans who plan to go to football's World Cup in Moscow this week were repeatedly warned to keep a low profile. Anti-queer violence has more than doubled in Vladimir Putin's Russia since he signed a law in 2013 making the dissemination of gay propaganda to minors a crime. And his government has denied numerous credible reports of a brutally murderous anti-queer purge in Chechnya, claiming that there are no LGBT people at all in that mostly Muslim region of the country. Social media has been filled with threats by thugs to attack any perceived to be queer fans at the World Cup. Members of the Cossack militia announced that they'd be patrolling a number of the games to help police prevent gay men from kissing. The first reports of homophobic violence came on opening day. A gay couple who had traveled from France to cheer on their national team was targeted and attacked in St. Petersburg after they caught a taxi. One of the men, identified only as O. Davrius, was hospitalized after the assault with severe brain trauma and a fractured jaw. His partner, who wasn't named, was less seriously injured. They were also robbed of their money and cell phones. Two suspects are reportedly already in custody.
But finally,
I dedicate this award to the countless LGBTQ people who have fought and died for the right to live and love as we are created to.
That's Andrew Garfield accepting the Best Lead Actor in a Play trophy at the annual Tony Awards on June 10th for his performance as Prior Walter in the Broadway revival of Tony Kushner's Angels in America. The multi-talented Nathan Lane took home the award for Best Featured Actor in a Play for his role as slimy, closeted gay lawyer Roy Cohn in Angels, and Tony Kushner himself accepted the Tony for Best Revival of a Play. For each of them, the personal was also political.
I want to thank Tony Kushner for being such an adorable genius. Even his emails are Pulitzer worthy. I'm standing here because Tony wrote one of the greatest plays of the 20th century, and it is still speaking to us as powerfully as ever in the midst of such political insanity. I want to send my thanks and love, most importantly, to my to my dear husband, Devlin Elliott, the greatest blessing in my life. Thank you very much.
21 weeks till November 6th, the midterm elections. 21 weeks to make sure that the right of citizens to vote is protected and exercised. 21 weeks to save our democracy and heal our country and heal our planet. And then, what kind of a homosexual would I be if I didn't say, it's June 10th, happy birthday, Judy Garland. Bye.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending June 16th, 2018, written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the all-new thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
He's a rebel and he'll never ever be any good. He's a rebel and he never ever does what he should.
Just because he doesn't do what everybody else does.
That's the reason why we can't share a love. He is always good to me. Good to him, I'll try to be. Cause he's my rebel and I know that up. He's my rebel and I know that up to me.
Charismatic, eloquent, a wit, and a smart aleck. That's how Lillian Faderman describes one queer icon in her latest book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. Those same words could be said of Faderman herself, who's a queer icon in her own right. The renowned LGBTQ historian talked about how she created a different kind of biography of Milk with Ralph Radabaugh and Rita Gonzalez of the KPFK Los Angeles podcast, The Out Agenda.
Lillian, besides the obvious, why Harvey Milk now, and why Harvey Milk at all? I mean, yes, he's a gay icon, incredibly interesting person, but what is it that inspired you to want to write a book about him?
I did a book called The Gay Revolution that came out in 2015, and I did a lot of research and interviews on Harvey for that book, and it's a huge book. It's an 800-page book, but I cover a period from 1948 to 2015. I finished just before it went to press. And, of course, I could only spend about maybe 15 pages on Harvey there. But I had discovered such interesting material that nobody had dealt with before. Randy Schiltz wrote a wonderful book about Harvey in 1982, the mayor of Castro Street. But the material that I found wasn't available to him. And Yale University Press came to me after the Gay Revolution, my 2015 book, came out, and asked if I would be interested in doing a book on Harvey for their series called Jewish Lives, and of course it took me about 10 seconds to say yes. I had just come to admire him, and to see him for the person he was, and he was in many ways very flawed. He had a lot of warts, as I discovered, but he was also so heroic, and I think I can say that I really came to love him. There was a documentary about his life, of course, the movie Milk in 2008, and he had been, I think, more honored than any gay person. He received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. There was a stamp with his image on it that was issued. There's going to be a ship named after him. It will be the U.S. Navy ship Harvey Milk.
Well, he was kind of interesting, too, in the fact that he didn't start out as an activist. I mean, he was born in New York, came to California, landed in San Francisco in Castro Street, and opened up a camera shop.
Yeah, he was a chameleon in the true sense of the word. He was an opera lover, even as a kid. He discovered opera at the age of 11. But he became a jock in high school and in college, too, maybe to hide that secret passion that he feared would somehow associate him with things effete. And so he played every single sport. He played football and baseball and basketball. He did wrestling. He ran track. He played soccer. In college, he even wrote for 3 years for the college newspaper as their sports columnist. Then he went into the Navy, and he was a deep sea diver in the Navy, and he came out, didn't know what he wanted to do, but he had a credential from college, and so he taught high school for 1 year. He was really unhappy doing that. He and his lover at the time went to Dallas, Texas, where he sold sewing machines. He was unhappy doing that. He came back. He finally got a job on Wall Street as a securities analyst. It's not the Harvey Milk that we know.
No.
And he got involved with someone who was in the theater, who was very much a hippie during the 1960s, and Harvey became a hippie, grew his hair long, became a real advocate of pot smoking, dressed in denim and had a huge mustache, looked very much like a radical in the 1960s, moved to San Francisco with his then lover. They didn't know how they would make a living, and the story is that they sent some film out to be developed at a store in the Castro, and it came back with all of the pictures virtually destroyed. And Harvey said to his lover, Scott Smith, we should open a camera store where we'll take good care of people's film. They didn't sell cameras. They couldn't afford it because they didn't have much money. But they developed film. They rented projectors. They had camera equipment, but very few cameras. They sold a few very inexpensive cameras. And in 1973, it was really a turning point in Harvey's life because the Watergate hearings happened, and he just absolutely hated Richard Nixon, but he watched the hearings faithfully. He hated John Mitchell. He hated John Dean. And he thought at that point, politics is really corrupt. Someone has to get into politics who will do it right, not the way Nixon and his team did it. He ran for office the first time in 1973. But, you know, he was complex even in his personality. For instance, he wasn't just on the Board of Supervisors to promote gay rights. He was very interested in promoting the rights of senior citizens. He was really interested in things like rent control, for instance. He was very interested in making coalitions with ethnic and racial minorities. He was very interested in helping young people and in the rights of young people. He was wonderful with people much of the time. I interviewed so many people who knew Harvey personally and who told me that when when he talked to them, he made them feel as though whatever they were saying was the most important thing to be listening to at that time. And yet, with his lovers, he could be so explosive, really sort of insensitive. He loved them. I found love notes that would really tear at anyone's heartstrings that he wrote to his lovers, and yet he didn't give them attention when they absolutely needed and craved his attention. He was too busy being a politician, and yet here was this guy who just absolutely loved humanity without a doubt. So that was a huge contradiction. I think he was really sincere in what he believed politically, and I think that drove him to become a politician.
If I'm fighting for gay rights, then either I'm a hypocrite or I have to fight for the rights of everybody. And once I fight for the rights of everybody, then I have to fight for the spending priorities of everybody, or I'm a hypocrite. And I don't think I'm a hypocrite, and that's why I've been involved in the issues of the district for so long, so hard.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio news magazine produced by, about, and for our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
I'm Rita Gonzalez, along with Ralph Radaba. We are speaking with Lillian Faderman on her new book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. How did you get all this other information on him?
Well, I did some interviews with family members who told me a lot about Harvey's family, and I write about that much more extensively than had been written about before. I start with the patriarch of the family. His grandfather came from Lithuania and was a peddler for a while, and it's just an incredible success story, so I start with that. I found letters that were not available when Randy Schiltz was writing the mayor of Castro Street, letters that were actually written to a young woman in Los Angeles. Harvey lived in Los Angeles for just a few months, but made friends with a young woman who became his confidant from 1955 to the early 1960s. And those letters were so revealing to me because Harvey told her so much of his personal life and his personal thoughts, and they had nothing to do with politics. They just had a lot to do with his romantic feelings. He had fallen in love with a young man by the name of Joe Campbell, and he was just so incredibly romantic in those letters to Susan Davis. Susan Davis Altsch, she was eventually called because she got married. At one point, Harvey was just so restless because he didn't know what he wanted to do with his life, and he spills that part of his life out to Susan Davis. So it was just a whole view of him that nobody had talked about before. I also discovered letters and notes that he wrote to the guy who was actually the director of Hair on Broadway and Jesus Christ Superstar, a man by the name of Tom O'Horgan. He and Tom O'Horgan became very good friends, and Tom was a correspondent even when Harvey moved to San Francisco. And when Harvey was finally elected to the Board of Supervisors, he wrote these wonderful notes to Tom O'Horgan that really gave another insight into him. Just his great pride in having been elected, and he wrote to Tom about how he was going to have a banquet celebrating his election, and Mervyn Dimely, who was the lieutenant governor of California, would be a speaker at the banquet, and he said something to the effect of, who would believe that this faggot would have a banquet in his honor in which the lieutenant governor would give a speech. And then he invited Tom O'Horgan to come to the banquet. He was invited by the San Diego Opera to sing sit in a VIP box to watch an opera singer that Harvey very much admired, who was already 68 years old, and Harvey had seen him when he was a kid at the Metropolitan Opera, where he was at, standing in the standing room. And he wrote to Tom O'Horgan about that experience, which was so exciting to him. He talked about sitting next to another famous opera singer in this VIP box. And he said to Tom O'Horgan, "Oh, life can be so wonderful." And I found that note so moving because it was actually written 2 days before his assassination.
It's amazing to have these letters that people had. I mean, nowadays people don't even do letters. It's just,
I know, I worry so much about,
I do too. I was thinking about that right now. I said, because that's how you found out about people, who they were by their letters, not emails.
Right. I don't know what future historians are going to do, because so much of these great archives where I've done so much of my work, the collections are mostly letters. And what's going to happen when there aren't letters like that?
Lillian, is there any chance that you have a short little passage from the book that you'd like to read?
Yes, I would be happy to do that, yeah. Should I read from the introduction? Is that
sure, if that's
way?
What you'd like to read from.
Okay. Harvey Milk, charismatic, eloquent, a wit and a smart aleck, was one of the first openly gay men to be elected to any political office anywhere. On November 18, 1977, soon after he won a seat on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, he made 3 tape recordings that he distributed to close friends, to be played only in the event of my death by assassination, he instructed at the beginning of each tape. Though he did not keep it a secret from associates that he had made the tapes, when his irreverent young City Hall intern, Cleve Jones, learned of them, he teased Harvey, "Hey, you're not Martin Luther King. You're not important enough." Harvey was shot to death 1 year and 9 days later by Dan White, a fellow supervisor who had complained that San Francisco was being turned into Sodom by men who would not hide their homosexuality, and that Harvey Milk was in the forefront of the city's abhorrent transformation. The words Harvey dictated into his tape recorder would have sounded foolishly melodramatic had he died a natural death, but with his murder, they took on the weight of prophecy. "If a bullet should enter my brain," he had said on the tape he made for his friend Frank Robinson, "let that bullet destroy every closet door."
I'm Rita Gonzalez, along with Ralph Radaba.
Our guest has been
Lillian Faderman with her book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death.
Every gay person must come out. As difficult as it is, you must tell your immediate family, you must tell your relatives, you must tell your friends if indeed they are your friends, you must tell your neighbors, you must tell the people you work with, you must tell the people in the stores you shop in, and once you do, you will feel so much better.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Jessica Andrea and Michael LeBeau, with thanks to Brian DeShazer, and from Rita Gonzalez and Ralph Radaba. Buena Vista performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the all-new thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 4NSA Noosa, Queensland, WJSC Johnson, Vermont, KOOP Austin, Texas, and on more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Indeed, this is your community radio station, KBOO Portland, and the time is right about 7 p.m., and next will be Calculated Conversation. Stay tuned.
KBOO is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting and the many people who are part of KBOO's history.
I came down to the Salmon Street Studios, where the federal courthouse is, the first official home of KBOO.
Came into this rather bizarre situation where we were in the basement of an attorney's office.
And at that meeting, he said, well, I'm just going to let you know that when your lease is up in about 18 months, we will not renew your lease. We will extend it for up to 6 months at double the rent.
When I was hired, they said, we want to be on the air by the end of July. I went, whoa, how much money do we have to pull this off? And they said, we got $11,000. how are we going to build this facility with $11,000?
To hear the stories of people who helped make KBOO what it is today, go to 50yearsofkboo.fm and click on KBOO Stories Project.
First off, they'll say what it is, a festival.
Hey folks, I want to tell you about the first annual Best of the Northwest Vernonia Springs Music Festival. It's going to take place on July 7th, 2018. KBOO is our co-sponsor, and our headliners are Lloyd Jones and Baby Gramps.
Sometimes known as Sourdough Dolly.
Let's give him a pledge.